decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Okay, hello everyone, welcome back to Millennial X. And sorry about the slightly late start, as due to confusion. But I'm now here with Dudley from New Right Post. Dudley, welcome to Millennial. This is your first time on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and apologize to your listeners who showed up on time. I got my wires crossed with the time zone scheduling. So typical American Amerocentrism on my part.
Don't worry. It happens, as I said, it happens at least once every year with somebody. It's always quite difficult to... This is one of the main difficulties in arranging Millennial, because if I say it's 2 a.m. on the 14th to an American, that's on the 13th.
Yeah. And as you know, we're the center of the world, so we're not used to thinking about other people's time zones. But yes. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to be on here.
Well, that's fine. And I appreciate what you've been doing with Substack, especially that you've promoted several, certainly Aryan Blues last year you promoted, and I was very grateful for that. So would you like to introduce yourself and then New Right Post itself?
Sure. So I go by Dudley New Right, and I'm otherwise anonymous. And 2 years ago, I started a weekly newsletter. It started out biweekly, and I did that for the first year and a half or so, and was basically collecting what I thought was the best writing, the best tweets, the best memes, the best podcast episodes twice a week in a kind of digest that I publish on Substack, which is called the New Right Post, P-O-A-S-T. And the goal is to kind of present the cream of the crop for those of us who aren't as addicted to it as I am. I found myself spending so much time on Twitter in particular, but also Substack and YouTube and various other places, just lurking and consuming this content myself. And I thought, man, it would be nice if someone would just aggregate the best of the best so that I don't have to, be online for hours a day. So I just decided to start doing that. And if you go back and look at some of the earlier issues, it was quite small. I would share maybe 10 or 15 links with each issue. But now I've gotten to a point where it's more like 50. And actually, I just dropped an issue this morning, and there were like 17 best reads of the week. And I'm thinking, who has the time to read even 17 of these? Of course, I'm reading dozens of them to get to the point where I can whittle it down to 17. But my gosh, there's just so much great stuff out there these days. Where I tweeted earlier saying that we're living in a real golden age of content for the dissident sphere. Just so many interesting ideas and opinions floating around. And so I try to boost what I can and be the kind of like curator of the scene.
Well, in a way, it's a good problem to have, the sheer abundance of stuff, because I can remember the early 20, like, well, when I started it was 2014, but before that I can remember the 2010, and there really wasn't much at all. Even in 2014, there really wasn't much. I mean, there were a couple of other British YouTube channels, but sadly they fizzled out. And obviously my one grew, and then others joined that. And likewise in America and Canada and so on, and all these other countries throughout Europe. But the point is that back then, it's like that thing about the last man who knew everything, because there was a point in time where one man could conceivably know everything, but then knowledge ballooned and exploded all these fields of study, and so it was completely impossible for one man to know everything anymore. There was a time when one person could keep up with everything going on in our sphere. You could pretty much watch every YouTube channel, listen to every podcast, pretty much read every article. It would be a lot of time, but you could do it. At this point, that's completely impossible, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I do my best, and I still find myself missing things. You know, people send in stuff, or they'll comment and say, like, how could you not include XYZ? And I think I don't know how I missed that. You know, it just didn't cross my feed. And the algorithm does a pretty good job of making sure I see the biggest bangers on Twitter. But, you know, Substack in particular, I follow like 150 people now. And I feel like that gives me a pretty good cross-section of the community. And some of those people are more on the kind of religious side. Some of them are more on the, you know, so-called Nietzschean vitalist side. Some of them are, you know, post-feminist. Some of them are, you know, there's just I like to say that the dissident right defines itself more by what it's against than what it's for. And we've all sort of agreed that the enemy is this, you know, gray goo, global homo liberalism. And, but yeah, I mean, I think that it really expanded, or exploded around the rise of Trump, because I think Trump gave a lot of folks the courage to, let's say, move away from their more libertarian, ideology and toward a firmly conservative or proper right wing point of view, which before, and I mean, I'll include myself in this. You know, I kind of didn't, it was a lot harder to be, to self-identify as a conservative or a right winger when the neocons were in charge of everything. And, I mean, one might say that they still are, but, at least we sort of have a glimmer of what another world might look like now.
It's interesting because at that point, like, let's say prior to 2016, prior to Trump's victory then, but even after, like even during his first presidency, there was a certain type of person who was a Republican in America. There was a certain type of dullard, frankly, who was part of that machinery and who subscribed to those ideas. And so I think there were a lot of people of our ilk in America who didn't have anything that they could cleave to. And I think that's really why the alt-right, the dissident right, emerged in the first place, the reactosphere back in the day. Because there was no, we simply didn't fit into, and still in Britain today, we absolutely don't fit in with the Conservative Party or even Reform. So there was a need for a sphere. I think that's one nice thing about this, the fact that it emerged organically. It really, there was a need for it. It wasn't organized. It wasn't conceived and designed. It was very spontaneous.
Yeah, and I think it's, of course, the Biden years, which were defined by the apotheosis of the woke movement, along with the pandemic lockdown era, really drove home the need for this. Because I think that when I first discovered these spaces, and this is probably going back to around 2015, 2016, you know, the woke thing was already in full swing by that time, and it only got worse from there. But it was sort of like, people say that women are kind of just consensus-based thinkers, and they just go wherever where the wind is blowing. And I think we're all kind of like that to a degree, and you're sort of fooling yourself if you don't acknowledge that about yourself. But just seeing these guys online speak honestly and directly without any kind of hedging or any attempt to appease the typical, you know, liberal referee that lives inside your head, I think was so refreshing and just life-giving, if I may be so corny. Because
it's true, though,
you're not getting that in real life, right? You're not seeing that around you because everyone's got their head down.
Yeah, and it's like people need permission to think certain things.
Sure.
Because while you're the only one, it feels like you must have made a mistake. You've gone down a bad path somewhere. You've lost sight of what's true because everyone else isn't with you. So it is a very scary place to be.
Yeah, and I think that it's what's crazy making about it is that a lot of us guys in this scene are otherwise successful, normal members of society, you know, who have, some of us have prestigious jobs, some of us are just completely living under the radar, incognito in these spaces that have been saturated by, so-called longhouse ideology. And day in and day out, the drudgery of having to, you know, not speak what you think in your head and hold that inside is, it just makes you insane. And so to hear these guys speaking like this was an epiphany and something that I wanted to be a part of, and, you know, something that I was willing to some degree take my chances at, you know, at the risk of getting doxxed one day. This is important enough to me to take that risk, and not to say that I'm going out on more of a limb than any of the other hundreds of guys who are out there posting, but I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't just go along with it without even making some small subversive stand in my own small way.
Yes. And what was your path into this? I mean, how did it, you know, your red pilling journey, so to speak? That's a phrase I haven't used for a long time, but
sure.
How did it all start?
It's actually a pretty well-trodden path. I guess I would say I was a libertarian. I grew up conservative. My parents were conservative Christian evangelical types, and they were functional people. They were good people, and I moved toward libertarianism, I think, if I'm being honest with myself, because, well, it appealed to my, you know, autistic sense of order and wanting to have a system that, you know, was governed by rules. But I think in hindsight, a lot of it probably also had to do with the fact that it was too embarrassing to just be a George W. Bush supporter. yeah. And for some good reason, right? I think when you can say you're a libertarian, someone's not going to say, oh, well, does that mean you don't want women to have the right to reproductive health? Or does that mean that must not mean that you hate minorities or whatever? Because in the U.S., if you're, and I'm sure it's like this in the U.K., if you're a straight up right winger, that's what that means to those people. So to say, oh, no, I'm a libertarian is a way to deflect some of that criticism. And I think I ended up reading Hans Hermann Hoppe at some point, whose main thrust of his work, Democracy, the God That Failed, is essentially that, this libertarian utopia can't exist as long as there's people who think communistly amongst you. And then, so what are you going to do about them? And his solution is to physically remove them from society. And then I got into Curtis Yarvin, and he has this metaphor about lifting up I'm going to bungle this, but it's something to do with like, it's easy to lift up a pencil that's lying on a table. You just, you know, grab it by the tip and lift it up. But what if it's a tree? You're going to need to bring in a heavy piece of construction equipment to make that tree upright. And basically that means is that you need to use power in order to turn society into something that's functional. And it's not just going to happen organically on its own through spontaneous order.
And this is the big problem with libertarianism, that it doesn't seem to accept that power is actually a necessity in the world.
Yeah. It's interesting to see this whole woke right thing, blow up over the last couple of weeks, with James Lindsay and his cohort of someone might charitably call them center right, libertarians. And, I think a lot of what his ideology seems to boil down to, I mean, there's a component of, you know, Israel issues there, but I think the lion's share of it is just that they are threatened by the idea of conservatives using power rather than playing quote unquote by the rules or being principled, you know, simply using the power, whatever power we can get our hands on to reward our friends and punish enemies. To the center rightist, this is it's too far. And this is one of the things that I think defines the new right, is that we're saying it's necessary.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is why people are still dismayed that Trump didn't. He didn't pardon certain people, and he did pardon certain other people. Because the left would do that and do that. You know, they do punish their enemies. They do reward their friends. It is a reality. I think part of one of the big developments in our sphere over the last 5 years has been the newly grasped understanding of power and the reality of it. And I don't just mean like, as opposed to libertarians. I mean, the understanding, like with Academic Agent, his crowd, I think, have done a lot to wake people up to the reality that you have to make, like, ideology almost comes second, and desires, your social vision comes second. The first thing is actually having power. And the sad reality is that a lot of people who are good at getting power are the types who don't have any vision. They don't care. They just want power. And it's the idealism that often prevents people from succeeding and getting power. The fact that they won't betray certain principles and so forth.
I think that, I don't know if it was Aaron McIntyre that coined this, but that phrase, he who just wants to be left alone is always going to get steamrolled by he who's willing to use power, or something like that. That was sort of like the last straw for me. I heard that quote and I was like, this is everything that I, you know, this explains so much of what bothers me about libertarianism. I can finally let go of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for me with liberty, I mean, I let go of libertarianism quite a long time before this, I think, like for other reasons, but I remember hearing a Greg Johnson speech called the Refutation of Libertarianism. It was on YouTube. And there was a particular line in that. He said, the individualist game blinds its players to collectivist cheats. Hmm. And I loved that. It really made an impression on me when I heard those words. The individualist game blinds its players to collectivist cheats. Stefan Molyneux actually said a similar thing where he made an analogy about a football game, and if one team is always passing the ball to just any other player, then the other team will win.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a path straight to defeat.
Yeah, I noticed that, you know who Jeffrey Tucker is?
No, I've heard the name, but he's
a prominent libertarian. I think he was actually involved with Ron Paul at one point.
Yes, I do know.
He's an old, like, I think he's a Mises Institute guy. He wears a bow tie a lot, like all the other academic libertarians. I think a couple weeks ago, he did kind of a mea culpa about how COVID clued him in to how essentially, like, it got him on a path of thinking about collectives and power that his libertarian brain wouldn't let him think about before. And he's now even starting to think differently about immigration. For example, he was an open borders libertarian previously. And now he's realized that essentially power uses mass immigration to undermine native workers. And this all sounds like commie bullshit, right? Like native workers, working class, like we don't think in these terms. But you have to, right? Like this is because this is how the world works. And I mean, that cliche about communism working on paper but not in practice. You know, the same thing's true for libertarianism. It's like, okay, if we could develop a society where we're all exclusively high IQ Anglos who share the same religion and philosophy of what the world ought to be, that anarcho-capitalist utopia might pan out for, you know, a generation or two. But we're a ways off from that.
Oh, definitely. This is just, again, I'm sorry to keep using the word reality, but it is just part of the reality of life on Earth. Groups compete against each other. Groups use other groups against their rival groups. There are all these different dynamics. And if you just instead blind yourself to groups, then you simply will not understand what is going on and the situation that you are a part of, that you are enmeshed in. You simply won't be able to grasp what's going on. I mean, it's like somebody priding themselves on being colorblind. Like, well, I don't see green. Well, that's not actually something to boast about. It's a retardation in a way when it's intellectual like this. And of course, race is another thing. When people say they don't see race, it's similar. Well, okay, you're just telling me that you have an incomplete perception of the world. You're not telling me that you're a good person or that you're more intelligent or that you're more aware. You're telling me that you're an idiot. Yeah. And I can't take seriously anything that you say because you are blind to this key aspect of the world.
Yeah, it's like you might not care about race, but race cares about you.
it's going to
come to bear upon you in some way.
Exactly. It's like saying you don't see gravity or something like that. I don't see oxygen.
I mean, they see race, you know. The other races are very keen on racial, you know, detecting the racial dynamic in any given situation.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think perhaps a reason that a lot of people became libertarians in the 2000s was that at that time race, especially in America, I'm thinking about the American context here, at that time race was kind of, it wasn't the big deal that it is now and that it has been throughout the 2010s. Race was passé, it was something that had been defeated, as it were. And I remember Obama calling himself the first post-racial president, this kind of thing.
Did he call himself that?
He did, yeah. Or other people called him that. I can't actually remember if he said it. I can't remember that now.
I don't dispute it. It just strikes me as quite a bit of self-puffery to make a claim like that about yourself.
Yeah, well, he did say things like that about himself, for sure. He was into self-puffery. But I won't swear that he said that exact thing about him, but definitely other people did. But the point is that the 2000s, I can see people thinking, well, there are no groups. So I can be a libertarian. It's safe to be a libertarian. And then obviously that falls apart in the 2010s because of the rise of what was called identity politics.
Well, that and just the decline of conditions as a result of that attitude, you know, crime increases, and you know, for the US and I imagine many parts of England, there are a lot of places where you simply do not interact with people who don't look like you. Less and less so every day. But you know, growing up, speaking personally, I, you know, didn't really know a ton. I mean, if I knew minorities, they were black kids. I didn't know any Mexican kids growing up. And I don't know what the numbers are between now and the early 90s, but it's a different world. And, you know, let's take Giuliani's New York City, for example. Like, you know, everyone knows about how he cracked down on crime really hard post 9/11. And I guess maybe that started pre 9/11, but
I think it did. It was the zero tolerance thing. I think that was the early 90s, if I recall.
Yeah. So throughout the 90s, there was like stop and frisk and a lot of controversies around you know, the police being too hard on, you know, the local populace, the local criminals. And but what resulted in that from that was a good decade and a half of bliss where crime was minimal and you could get around the city easily without running into trouble. And it's very easy to be, you know, race blind in a situation like that when things are good. And now, you know, we're seeing things turn. I've got friends in New York who aren't even conservative, who have candidly told me that things have gotten actually pretty rough and that they are constantly looking over their shoulder when they're outside. And, you know, it's a shame because we now know it doesn't have to be that way. You know, there are things you can do to make it not that way. And we just simply don't have the stomach to do them anymore. And, you know, maybe we're going to see a turnaround there too. I mean, if things get bad enough.
Well, yeah, this is a question that I was going to bring this to. So race became a big deal again in the 2010s. Do you think that Trump is going to reverse that and implement a sort of civic nationalist pride in being American, no matter, you know, like in the old, like the 90s kind of thing?
Yeah. There's been some chatter about this. Lomez, the account on Twitter, did a short thread about how he wants to, because we're about to have the 250th anniversary of the country. And this is, he suggested that this is an opportunity to go hard into civic pride and unity and kind of wind back some of the statue smashing and maybe even commission some more statues, but of, you know, the not necessarily the types of people who've been memorialized over the last 10 years, but the heritage figures. I think it's a great idea, and I would love to see it. And I think it would benefit Trump and it would benefit the country. And I think people are probably aching for something like that. An optimism, you know, that it operates at a very superficial level with the popularity of a movie, like the new Top Gun, which a lot of folks have written essays about that as a kind of like homage to the, you know, the 80s, confidence that America used to have. But then on a much deeper level, you know, it's, I think that what, say, like Chris Rufo is suggesting, this long march through the institutions, but with our guys, basically, I think that's another component of it that would, it might take another generation for the fruit of that to be revealed, but it does take time for those for us to undo what's been done.
Yeah, and the thing is that it's not just a matter of retiring, you know, boomer professors. There are plenty of Gen X and millennials in academia who are completely committed to this stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, it's difficult to extricate an ideology when people's salaries depend on furthering it. And I don't know. Is it something that could be? I think it seems to me that for an effort like this to be successful, it's a matter of building momentum. And it feels like we have a lot of momentum right now. I don't know if you've been following Yarvin's Substack, but it's the last four or five essays he's written have been all about how impossible it is to get anything done in Washington, how difficult bureaucracy is to navigate, and specifically about how the DOGE effort, the Vivek and Elon's effort to, what does DOGE stand for?
Department of Government Efficiency.
Yeah, that's right. I get that confused with RAGE, Retire All Government Employees. So Yarvin's been writing a lot about how these guys don't know what kind of challenges that they're going to face. because of the way that bureaucracy operates. There's no, it's like a hydra and you cut off one head and another one sprouts. Maybe that's true, but maybe that means we just need to think of it in a longer time scale. You know, we plant the seeds now and then, you know, our children or maybe our children's children will see the fruit.
Well, this is something that is really in the hands of Trump, because the president, I mean, isn't the emperor, but he does have more power, more autonomy than, for example, the British prime minister. It is within Trump's power, once he gets into the White House, to implement whatever changes are needed to do this clear out.
It's hard for me to get my head around what Trump actually believes. Because he didn't do a whole heck of a lot in his first term, and maybe that was, some people think that was intentional, and I don't know. I mean, he definitely is starting to put some people in place that are going to be more able and oriented in the right direction. And, I don't know. I have some high hopes, but I'm trying not to get too excited. I've never been so excited in my life for a president. And it's not even really him that excites me. It's this whole, all the people that he's putting in place. Some of them aren't my favorites, but it's just such a dramatic turnaround from what we've seen, aesthetically, spiritually, that it's hard not to get excited.
It does feel different than 2016, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I don't know, it seems like the people are ready for it. I mean, 2016 felt like the first battle, and this recent election felt like a far more decisive victory. It feels like the enemy is demoralized and running scared. And that was not the case at all in 2016.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like that was a sort of prototype for, or a dress rehearsal for what could happen now.
I sometimes wonder if I'm in an echo chamber. A lot of the people that I, quote unquote, hate follow just to keep an eye on things are now not even on Twitter. They're over on Blue Sky. And I can't bring myself to start up a Blue Sky account. The folks that I do see do not seem confident. It's a lot of doom and gloom on the left side. And that's a good signal. There's a part of me that I'm so embedded in the new right scene, and it's just nothing but white pills. And I wonder if I'm a little high on my own supply sometimes.
Well, this is always a danger, isn't it, for us? Because we are enmeshed in this. We read this stuff. We hear this stuff every day on Twitter and YouTube and whatever. And so, it's kind of like we got what we wanted. we got our own sphere. But the cost of that is a certain detachment from the normies, from the general public, and it can be difficult to keep abreast of where they are and what they're thinking about, what they're aware of, what they're pissed off about, what they want. I don't know. I think for people who have full-time jobs in the mainstream, it's probably a lot easier to keep up with that stuff because you hear it in the workplace. It has always seemed like a job that the challenge is to like shifting a hippo. You're trying to get the public to just see certain things and then act on them, especially the existential threat to them, the demographics, and the birth rates and so on. And it's always this challenge, do they realize yet? And so we tell ourselves, yeah, they're waking up. The normies are waking up. The normies are getting red pilled. The normies are realizing. I'm not really sure. The fact that they've now voted in America, they've voted for Trump twice, looks like the 2020 election was stolen. They voted, so effectively they voted for him three times. That would suggest to me that in America, at least, the general public, they're obviously not as burnt out and red-pilled as us, but they do realize that something is very, very wrong with the modern world, with America in the early 21st century.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's something that I, in doing the New Right post, like, it's been exciting to see the tenor of the conversation change over the last 2 years. And I definitely prefer it now to then. You know, I'd rather live in the world where, you know, maybe there's a little bit of cringe optimism and celebratoriness, but and it's exciting to see these ideas expand into the normie sphere. You know, I'm seeing, you know, we saw like Trump at the debate reference the Springfield cat eating, which was a Twitter meme from one of our guys. And that's just one example of that sort of thing where I was thinking the other day, did we coin the term slop that I'm seeing all over the place? Because I first heard it as Zog slop or Goy slop. And I've noticed that that term has now gone fully mainstream, and not Zog slop, but just the term slop, that to refer to any kind of like low effort, maybe it's AI generated type of content. Or you know, in the reference to food, like just garbage fast food slop.
Yeah.
I have a suspicion that that actually originated with our sphere. But we're...
I think it possibly did. But you see, I wouldn't have thought that that was relevant to the normies, because I thought it referred specifically to people within our own sphere who were producing stuff just to, just to make money. Just to placate, sort of satisfy the lowest instincts of people. That's what I thought slop was. Maybe I've been misinformed.
Yeah, well, I think it's been, it now refers to like there's a guy who's in media who worked at BuzzFeed for a long time who has a Substack newsletter that's very popular. And he did an essay about how slop to him refers to AI generated content that, you know, as AI gets better and better at creating text, videos, images, it's harder and harder to determine whether something was actually AI generated. But for now, you can still instantly tell. And, content farmers who've been doing this since the beginning of the internet, really, are taking full advantage of it and just filling our social media feeds with this stuff. And, I think his usage of the term refers specifically to that. But I think the reason why that word came to mind is because he came across our guys using it.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it is a problem. And AI is a whole thing in itself, a whole topic. Do you have much to say about that, given your privileged position as a surveyor of all that is said and written in our community?
Well, it's hard to make any kind of a blanket statement because it means so many things. I think my biggest fear with AI is that it, and my this is my big technology fear in general, is that it creates a kind of isolating effect where it meets your needs that otherwise would have been met by real humans. And I can easily imagine a dystopia where I'm plugged into a VR helmet and it's feeding me experiences that are tailored to my desires that are not necessarily good for me, and don't offer the kind of like friction that real life achievement might be able to provide. But in the same way that, you know, habitual video game addicts, porn addicts, you know, are able to isolate themselves, and instead of having real relationships that are difficult, can instead have this like simulation of a relationship or a simulation of an achievement that scratches that itch, but doesn't actually provide you with any long-term meaning or fulfillment. I think AI is going to accelerate that because I've played around with ChatGPT quite a bit and have found it extremely useful to the point where I'm using it almost more than I use Google. And as it gets better and better at telling me what I want to know, I can easily imagine it getting better at telling me what I want to feel and becoming the kind of like companion that feeds into my unhealthiest urges. And I was talking to somebody today about how there's a lot of these companies that are basically, you know what Cocomelon is?
No, I don't.
Cocomelon is a extremely popular show for very young children. It's sort of like the Teletubbies of right now. And they did this study on kids watching the show, and they were able to pinpoint the exact moment when the child loses interest in the show and looks away. And once they found that moment, they cut to a new camera angle at that moment. And so in Cocomelon, if you watch it, they cut every like 10 seconds, or I think it might even be 6 seconds. It's, you know, because the kid has an attention span, and these are like 2-year-olds. They're very young. Sometimes they can't even talk yet, but they're watching the show, and they just, their brains are, being, you know, fed this drip of, entertainment that is tailored to precisely, you know, give them what they are interested in seeing before they lose, you know, interest. And, then I thought, once they start using machine learning on this stuff, not only are they going to know that precise time, but, you know, in the same way that TikTok is able to just give you this constant drip of fascinating, intriguing, in some cases, almost pornographic images that are exactly what your brain wants to see in that moment. They're going to do the same thing with kids. And I thought, this is what like the experience of being a poor kid is going to be, is, your mom or your daycare worker is just going to hand you the iPad, and you're going to be locked in to something that is far more hellish than Cocomelon, which already feels totally dystopian to me. And yeah, like what's that going to do to childhood development?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see it being something that it ends up being mass produced, but and used by the poorer, the less informed, because it will just keep their kids occupied. It is a thing. It's a process that has been going on for all of my lifetime. You must remember the phrase that was used a lot in the 90s. People would refer to MTV editing. And they would mean it's fast, it's sort of like yeah. Constant sugar rushes, it's shallow. But at that time, the average length of a pop song was like 3.5 to 4 minutes, and now I think it's 2.5 minutes, or even less, like 2 minutes. And they get to the chorus immediately. It opens with the chorus because that's the catchy bit, that's the hook, and then. It's refined to this point where I don't even need to describe it. It's obvious. Yeah. It's just completely vapid.
And it's not, it's entertainment, it's food, it's experiences of all kinds. Like I feel like dating right now, I got married before the apps really took off, Tinder and all that stuff. But I have friends who use it. And I know this one guy who is single and came to visit me in my city that he didn't even live in, and I couldn't get him off the swiping the whole time he was there. Like I would just catch him swiping in the middle of a conversation. Are you familiar with Tinder and how it works?
Vaguely. I know that you swipe left or
swipe right, depending on whether you think the girl is worth, you know, learning more about. It just presents you with a scroll of images of women, if you're a man or a heterosexual man, and you swipe left or right, and it's an action that can take less than a second. And what I realize is that this guy was addicted to the endorphin rush of, or the dopamine rush of, like the fantasy of meeting some new girl. That, and the way Tinder works is that if they also swipe right on you, so if there's a mutual reciprocating interest in one another, it then gives you their contact information, and then you can DM each other. And I came to realize is that he was like a perpetual first dater. He would just go on one date with these girls and then immediately lose interest. And
because there's a thousand other girls.
It wasn't even about the sex. It was about just meeting someone new. And all of that is like algorithmically done, you know, on the Tinder app. And it's just another one of these examples of technology and AI kind of giving you exactly what you want to your detriment. And I think that's like my big overarching concern about AI. It's too good at giving us what we want.
Yeah. I mean, this is a thing that a lot of people have said about social media, like with Twitter, for example, that it is an endless scroll. It just goes on and on and on and on and on. You can constantly find new opinions, new tweets that are of interest to you. And, you know, and most of them are. So it's it means that social media, of course, this is the whole point. The algorithm, the framework of each platform, it's designed to keep you hooked, to get you addicted.
And yeah, we have to be honest with ourselves as posters. This stuff is acting on us in the same way that Cocomelon is on a kid.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm on Twitter, I'm almost as locked in as those iPad kids who are sitting there drooling, watching CGI, you know, entertainment for, you know, made for 2-year-olds.
Yeah.
That's basically the same thing.
Yeah. Would you say that Substack is less like that? I mean, let's talk about Substack as a platform, because it's obviously one that's of interest to you.
Sure.
It's of interest to me as well. I've got things to say about it, but it's not about me. So why don't you give your perspective of Substack, how it operates, how it differs from other platforms, and how it fits into that ecosystem.
Twitter was always actually very hard for me to get into, because I appreciated the old blog world, you know, of the early 2000s of long form writing, where you could really let an idea breathe and make an argument. And it wasn't just this kind of a feeding frenzy the way that Twitter can be. I've now actually had some success on Twitter, and I think part of that is because for the first time ever, I can actually say what I think under my pseudonym, which has given me the opportunity to, I think, express ideas that were much more honestly. But I love Substack, and the thing that I'm actually currently most excited about, even though I've just spent the last 20 minutes trashing AI, is their AI narration feature. Where you can hit a play button on the mobile app and it'll use an AI narrator to read the article to you. And as someone who actually reads dozens of these things every week, it's been a life changer for me, because I can just, cooking dinner, doing the dishes, cleaning up, I can throw on one of these articles and just bang them out one after the other. And, I love it. It's like, I wish that I could just put any article into the Substack app. I actually messaged the founder of the company to say, like, I want this to be my e-reader so that anytime I have an article anywhere on the web, I could just shoot it over into the Substack app somehow and use this AI narration feature. But beyond that, it's an exciting community to be a part of, although I feel like their introduction of notes undermines a little bit about what made them special, although I kind of understand why they introduced it.
Well, let's go into what makes it special, though. Let's outline what Substack offers, because that's what a lot of people won't be familiar with.
Well, if you're not on there, it's a place to post. It's what used to be called a blog, but it's the distribution mechanism is via email. So it's an email newsletter that works as a blog if you want to go and look at other writing by the same author. But I think the special sauce is that not only is it a blog and an email newsletter, it's also a social network. You can follow people, you can comment on their stuff, you can create your own reaction to it on your Substack. So there's it's sort of a mix of a blog and a social network and a newsletter, and presses blend on those three things. But I think that what differentiates it from Twitter is that, like I said, when you give ideas room to breathe, it's you don't have the frantic sense of one-upsmanship that people seem to have on Twitter, where you're just constantly looking for an opportunity to dunk, or a fear that you're going to be dunked on. I don't really see that so much. I mean, it's more cerebral because of that long form nature. You don't have that kind of chatter going where, yes, people are shit talking each other. It's, you might get the equivalent to that is like a well-reasoned 600 word rebuttal to something that you've written, either in the form of a comment or in the form of somebody else's Substack essay, which is, if you want to be an adult, that's obviously preferable to the Twitter experience, where you can just constantly effortlessly throw pot shots at one another. So I think it allows people to be more confessional, to be more intimate, and just to make an argument that can't be contained in whatever the character limit is on a tweet right now, 280 characters. It's something. Sometimes the essays that I read are like almost book length, like 20,000 words or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's like as long as any magazine article you'll ever read. And some of them are amazing, like as good as anything that you would find in the New Yorker magazine. Actually, this week, I think I mentioned there were 17 essays that I featured. One of them was this extremely long look at this sovereign city plan in South America, where they're trying to build like a kind of a libertarian crypto polity down there, and the challenges that they're facing. And I feel like every couple of years you see an article about these people, like the Seasteaders, and Rolling Stone or Vanity Fair will send a reporter, and they're just dripping with disdain, right? Because they see a bunch of libertarian nerds, and all they can do is talk crap. And but this was the Mars Review of Books, which is a right wing literary organization, and they published this great essay, and I was happy to highlight it because it didn't look like it had a ton of reach. So yeah, there's just diamonds out there that are waiting to be discovered, and I kind of see that as part of my role on Substack in particular, because Twitter is way more networked. And sometimes with Substack, I think people feel like they're just shouting into the void, and sometimes they are, and it's because they're a subpar writer, but other times it's just, they haven't found their audience yet. And I'm just shocked sometimes at the quality of the output that I see.
Yeah. I sometimes find Substacks and I think, how does this person not have more fans and more, because it's such good quality writing. It's good work. That's a real shame. But this is part of the, this is a result of what is Substack's strength in a way, which is that it doesn't have an algorithm for pushing stuff at you. And, right. and this is how it, it, the really big difference between it and all other social media platforms, they're the absence of an algorithm.
That's
so,
a good point.
Yeah. And well, this is what they pride themselves on. I mean, they, I get their emails now and then talking about new features, and they're always doubling down on this commitment to being different from everyone else, different from every other platform. And this is their big thing, that it's really about, for them, it's about facilitating a relationship between a writer and his readers, rather than curating what those readers look at. But the as you say, the other side of that is that it means you're kind of on your own. You still have to promote your own work yourself, because Substack, the platform, won't do that for you. It's the opposite of YouTube in the old days, where it was astonishing. I mean, the algorithm was so good at spreading a channel and giving it exposure, because it would just it would do exactly what it was supposed to do. It would find it would present you with things that, given your previous viewing, you would probably be interested in. And of course, in the age of censorship, 2017, 2018 onwards, it just kept, it was limited to Jordan Peterson videos. It would always show you whatever you were watching, as if it was vaguely right wing, it would present you with a Jordan Peterson video afterwards. So that,
this is actually a, I have a real bone to pick with YouTube about this, because I feel like there was a golden age there before that phenomenon really got going, where you could really go down a rabbit hole. And I'm really into music. And one of the nice things about YouTube is that you can find any music video and, you know, live shows, obviously song uploads. And, you know, you could, like, indie bands from the early 80s that no one's ever heard of. They, you know, there were a lot of them that I had never even seen a picture of them. And you could go on YouTube and see, like, old live footage of them playing some dingy venue and, you know, to a small crowd. And I just thought, man, what a blessing this is to have in my life. And you would watch one video, and then it would show, it would present to you 10 or 15 other videos about that particular band or other bands in that scene or other bands in that genre. And it was extremely good at, you know, whatever it was working. And then something, they flipped a switch and it was just Jordan Peterson videos or, you know, stuff that I had already seen, Ben Shapiro stuff and, you know, Jimmy Fallon videos and mainstream stuff that I had zero interest in. But I believe the reason why they did that is because they wanted to help content creators who were trying to make a living out of it, make money so that they would continue uploading content. You know, the random guy who posts a live video of a band from 81, he's not trying to make a living. He's not monetizing in any way. So the algorithm stopped being so good, basically, and it just tried to shunt you into watching yet another Destiny debate, which I really resented.
Well, certainly, but it also disallowed certain channels like mine and many others. So, you know, we were trying to get exposure and make a living on there and so on, but the algorithm worked against that. But again, always with Jordan Peterson.
Yeah.
To shunt people towards a more mainstream option, who would then discourage them from looking any farther. I mean, that was clearly a conscious decision at YouTube. They were clearly doing that. But to get back to Substack, because that's all historical now. Well, it's still going on, but nonetheless, to get back to Substack, it's the absence of the algorithm that they tout as a great strength, and it does seem to be a great strength in the sense that it keeps the platform as a contemplative space rather than a competitive space or a slop space or something that's dictating to you. It very much allows you to find what you're looking for, but that requires effort on the reader's part and on the writer's part. And as I said about self-publicity,
Go ahead.
Sorry, it is difficult compared to when I think about YouTube in the early days. You could kind of just let the platform do it for you. It was quite, it just happened. You know, it was kind of magical. On Substack, it's very different. I mean, I've been going for 2 years, and I'm still, obviously I'm grateful to all of my readers, but I do wish that I had more because I would like to make a living on there. I think it is just a different experience altogether. In that sense, I think it is very original. I think it is, you know, they call themselves the future of social media. I can't remember the exact phrase they used, but perhaps it is going in that way because people are sick of algorithms.
You know, it's funny, this phenomenon of it not pushing you towards stuff that it thinks you want to see is never more apparent than when you look at the leaderboards of what's actually popular on Substack. And you see the people that are huge on there and you realize like it's not all a bunch of, you know, freakish right wingers like me. It's actually a bunch of shit libs. And they're, you know, like in the regular, you know, like everywhere else, they dominate. And, you know, it's a testament, I think, to the people who run Substack that they've chosen to allow us to have our little corner that isn't constantly being, you know, not constantly exposing us to stuff that we wouldn't be interested in for various reasons.
Well, you know, this time last year, or just after Millennial, I think it was in early January this year, Substack was attacked by various people it's clearly a concerted, organized thing, for not being censorious enough, because they had this commitment to freedom of speech, which for some reason they got away with for a long time. But then there was this effort to force them. And it's weird. See, this is what interests me. It interests me, first of all, that Substack weren't censorious in the first place. But second, it interests me that they survived this attempt to force them to be censorious. Because if you remember what happened with Patreon, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was MasterCard just told them, you're going to do this, or you're not going to have any payment processing. So Patreon, I mean, I'm sure that they didn't have to be forced. I'm sure that a lot of their staff are probably the most awful shit libs. But nonetheless, they were forced, because otherwise it would have been the end of Patreon.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what it would take to break Substack, break their will, because obviously Stripe not doing business with them, it's like, where do you do? You know, where do you go from there? I don't know. I was actually pretty worried around this time last year, and I was pleasantly surprised that they did not kowtow. They stood firm. And like, was that the last gasp, I wonder, of that kind of censoriousness?
I think that Trump, I do actually think that because Trump's won the election, that is going to, I mean, and I'm not hysterically, you know, some cheerleader for him. I don't believe he's going to solve everything and rescue Western civilization. But I do think that this is his being in the White House, I think it is going to put a stop to this, because I do think that censorship has peaked. I think I said this last Millennial, and I still think that now. I still think, I mean, Keith Woods was banned from YouTube earlier this year, a few months ago. Has anyone, I mean, and that's bad. I don't like that, but it's, there it is. But has anyone else been banned from YouTube this year? No. And indeed last year, I don't think any of our guys were banned. There are still plenty of our guys there. It's not like it was. It's not the sort of garden, the ecosystem that it was. But nonetheless, there are plenty of our guys there still. And they're not being banned.
It's encouraging.
I do think that has peaked. And then on top of that, Trump's election, I think, and he has explicitly said that he wants to put a stop to online censorship, you know, for political banning people for political reasons.
Yeah,
he wants
the effort by Matt Taibbi with the Twitter files and the giving a name to the censorship industrial complex. And I don't know if you saw the, you know, Mike Benz on Rogan.
I didn't, but I know who that is. It's Frame Games from the old days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's rebranded as a internet censorship guy, or maybe he was doing that earlier as well. He just did 3 hours on Joe Rogan, which I consider to be a kind of a must watch. And I said as much when I covered this in the New Right Post, all about the NGO sphere behind the censorship industrial complex and the organizations that, you know, the transnational organizations that are using American taxpayer money and probably taxpayer money from other countries as well, to pressure tech companies to be more censorious. And no one, I mean, people talked about censorship, but they hadn't quite created an org chart, which we now have, of how all these organizations are working together. And I think that now that we have a name for the censorship industrial complex, and I think those people understand that they're being watched now. You know, the watchers are being watched for the first time in a new way. And listening to him talk about it on Rogan, which is the biggest entertainment property in the world, was very encouraging to me because now, you know, normies are aware of it too.
Well, absolutely. This was a huge thing. Like in 2019, 2020, that there was a real need to get awareness of this problem out there, because I think a lot of people simply didn't know that there was that this was going on. I remember I've told this story before, but I'll say it again. There was I think it was called a congressional hearing, where they had these the heads, the CEOs of various social media companies, being brought in, and they were questioned, and they had this Republican guy asked, I think it was Mark Zuckerberg, he asked, so what are you doing to fight hate speech on your platform? And so that's a Republican working against the interests of right wingers, and he was the old guy, you know, boomer. I don't think he really, it was just infuriating. Because I thought, you don't even know what you're there to do. You don't even know what your job is in this scenario. You're working for your enemy. And it was enraging. But now it's completely different now. I mean, I think that everyone now knows what they've been up to, what's been going on for the last 5 or 6 years. Well, actually 7 years, because it really started at the end of 2017. And I'm so glad. I mean, it's because we've moaned about it so much. I don't know how many minutes of millennial over the years have been spent moaning about the censorship problem. But finally, it does seem to be very widely recognized, and including by Trump, which isn't surprising given that it happened to him. But again, it's one of these typical things where it has to happen to the person before they wake up and realize that it's a real thing.
Yeah. Well, if you're not a digital native, I think especially it's difficult, because in the grand scheme of things that are problems with the world, you know, I remember having an argument about this decades ago about the like internet privacy and the importance of the ability to speak your mind without your identity being attached. I can't believe we're still having this conversation, by the way. You know, this was back in 2008 or something. And, this woman just couldn't get her head around why she should give a shit about internet privacy. And, you know, she was like, my parents, are retired and they don't, their social security income doesn't cover their expenses. And, you know, you know, and she would just rattle off a bunch of other problems. And I feel like it's probably a kind of an autistic male brain thing to worry about the second, third, and fourth order effects of something like internet censorship and internet privacy. It's like you have to be able to think of the system and how it might break down if people aren't able to speak their minds online.
Oh, absolutely. And you've also got the desire to see and read things that aren't part of the consensus. That is very male and yeah, pretty autistic at the end of the day. So, yeah. You know, your average woman is just not going to care about this. It's just, I don't care if that sounds sexist. It's just a fact. I mean, it's obvious. So you can understand it from her point of view because she's got real, what seemed to her like much more real concerns.
Material problems.
Yeah, exactly. More immediate. So why would she care about something like that? But of course, in the long term, you should care about something like this because it's, you know, we are supposedly living in free societies and freedom of speech. You might not really care about it until you lose it and need it.
Right.
And then suddenly it's really, really important. Yeah. I think a lot of people, like if I use the term normies again, normies don't really have a need for freedom of speech because they've got nothing controversial to say at all. So,
yeah,
by definition, so it's something that is needed for those who have controversial ideas, according to the mores of their time. So everyone else really doesn't need freedom of speech. And so it's always going to be a minority concern by definition.
Yeah. And I feel like we're still, I said, I can't believe we're still having this conversation, but like you're still seeing the, you know, it's not to rag on Jordan Peterson so much, but he famously over the last couple of years has come out against anonymity. And that if you should just have the confidence to show your face if you have something to say. And I just have, like, I'm so exhausted by these guys. I just have no tolerance for this attitude anymore. Because not only does it show that they don't have anything challenging to the regime to say, otherwise they wouldn't think that, but it also shows a complete ignorance of, you know, what I would call the battle space of like the stakes at play right now, the kind of like the position that we're in, which is not in a position of power. And we have to be able to, just like the founding fathers of the United States did, speak under a pseudonym in order to speak truth to power without having our lives wrecked. And, you know, I also have a lot of affinity for the face lords among us, who are there by intention or through having unfortunately been doxxed. If you have made done the math in your head that exposing your identity is going to help you get your message out there and putting something on the line is like, I celebrate that and I support it, but it doesn't work at scale. Like it.
No, it's completely unrealistic to expect a great number of people to do that. Because people have priorities. They've got families, they've got mortgages, they've got jobs. They don't want to lose everything. That's just human nature. I mean, you can say, well, they should care about the cause enough to risk everything, but, you know, good luck. Good luck with that. It's not going to happen. But Jordan Peterson, I don't want to get into that topic of him because it just infuriates me, but I just see him as a fool at this point. If he ever did have any wisdom, I think it's been drugged out of him. And I think he's sold his soul to the Daily Wire and so on. The thing is, when he says those words that you should stand by and be give your real name and your face and your postal address and so on, when he says that, he probably thinks that he has walked the walk, that he has controversial things to say. But that's a delusion because at the same time, he'll revile people who are to his right and call them all sorts of terrible names and ascribe, you know, psychological conditions to them, psychopaths, narcissists. I can't even remember them all now. But The point is that the lie is given by his own conduct. He's outraged by anyone more, not even more right-wing, but more nationalistic than him. He is offended and outraged by their very existence. So the idea
that anonymous troll demons.
Exactly, anonymous troll demon. So the idea that he can say that they've got nothing to fear when he himself is attacking them.
Yeah. I mean,
again, what can you say? He's just a fool.
Yeah. Really, well, the Bulwark did a essay. They ran an essay about this last week from today, about how internet anonymity allows people to avoid stigma by leading dual lives. They see that as toxic. And that doxing isn't so bad. And my response to that is that anyone who says this is not our friend. And you know, the Bulwark has already, you know, every day given us a reason to think that. But you're familiar with the Bulwark, right?
Yes. Okay. but the audience might not be so.
Yeah, it's just a center-right magazine, digital magazine that I have to imagine only boomers actually subscribe to. Anyone saying that is an enemy, and at worst and at best, they're just dead weight. They're getting in the way. They don't get it.
Yes, exactly. They just don't get it. That's the nub of it. Well, we should probably end now because the next stream is due to start in 10 minutes. But is there anything that you would like to say about Substack and about specifically your Substack before we wrap up?
Like I said, I've been doing this for 2 years and I've never charged for it because I mainly, selfishly, didn't want to give my personal information to Stripe. But I've decided that, probably next week I'm actually going to turn on paid subscriptions. So if there's anyone out there who has a based friend and in need of a Christmas gift, feel free to check us out. I think I've sung the praises of the people in the scene that are just creating so much content. Before I did this, I used to follow, there was an account called longform.org and then another one called Longreads. And they would basically collect the most interesting articles from places like Scientific American, National Geographic, The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, all the mainstream magazines. And I loved it. I used to just read and read and read all the best stuff from all these periodicals. And something happened in the mid-2010s that made it almost unbearable. And part of it was that the content itself was obnoxiously woke. And then the other thing is that the curators would only pick the stuff that was along those lines. And so they would do these best of the year lists at the end of the year. And it was one thing after the other where there had to be some sort of social justice angle. There wasn't just any interesting stories being written anymore that didn't have that. And so, you know, if you want to read good stuff, check us out. New Right Post on Substack and on Twitter. Post spelled POAST in homage to 4chan speak. And at the end of the year, we're going to be doing probably the first week of January, the best of the year. So best tweets of the year, best reads, and also best memes, which is a way to, I don't mean meme like funny picture, but just ideas. Like, what are the most interesting ideas that defined 2024? Stuff like Jew tunnels. What kind of X are you? Like, what kind of from that movie Civil War?
Yes.
Will Stansel, Wife Jack. The Ayla gangbang. Christ is King, which became a big touchstone.
Mid-year. Your Body, My Choice.
Your Body, My Choice. Yes, the October 7th fratty white boy counter protesters. Ausländer Raus. Trump at McDonald's. The Trump fight image.
Yes,
Steve Saylor's noticing. I've got about 50 of these things, and I'm going to write little mini essays on them. And the goal is to kind of contextualize the year and what did it mean, and what did we move forward on? What were the challenges? And you know, they're eating the cats from the Trump.
Yeah,
all these things taken together, I think, it's a way to describe the new right, because we're doing this kind of participatory culture. We're creating these fun memes that we can all partake in. And to me, that's just as interesting as the essays and the joke tweets.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a really good idea, because I can imagine it acting as a sort of historical record of our 2024, our 2025, what was going on in the movement in that time, because of course you forget this stuff.
I was going
through what meme was popular in 2019. I couldn't tell you.
I was going back. So we did this last year too. And number one from last year, can you guess what it is?
No.
Longhouse.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that was an idea that just became as important as any other right wing, like talking point. The other top five were No Enemies to the Right, the burning Robert E. Lee statue. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was horrible.
The melting down of the Robert E. Lee statue.
Awful. Yeah.
Natalism and the boycott of Bud Light.
Oh, of course, with the transgender person. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name. That's great. I think more than in the moment, I think historically, like 5-10 years from now, I think those records will be very valuable, actually. So I think that's a great idea. I'm really glad you're doing that.
Thank you. Can I plug one more small thing? Do I have time?
Yeah.
So if anyone hasn't checked it out, I dipped my toe into original writing this year. I wrote my first essay as Dudley Newright, and it's called Millennial Snot. Or on Millennial Snot. Did this cross your feed at any point?
I did. I think you maybe linked it to me at some point, but I've definitely read it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you read it. It's about the phenomenon of millennials in particular, but libs of all stripes, who speak in a very condescending, snippy, juvenile tone, which became the kind of default mode of speaking for libs, and has contributed to their political program of simply needing to educate the unwanted masses and enlighten them with the true knowledge.
It's not my job to educate you.
Yeah.
Go and read a book.
And yet they won't stop trying to educate us.
Well, part of their self-image is that they are more enlightened than us and better than us.
Yes.
Again, I like to think that that is crumbling now, but that is...
Yes, I think the Kamala defeat was very symbolic on that front, because it was an indictment of that credentialed class who are forever peering their noses down at the chuds.
Yeah. I love that word. It is so funny.
Yeah. Someday I'm going to do the best memes ever, the best new right memes ever. Not just of the year, but of all time. And Chud will definitely be up there.
Good. There are two super chats. Jay says, thanks for all your efforts, MW. Thank you. You're welcome. And the Silva Tici says, have you ever seen Her, the 2014 film with Joaquin Phoenix about a man falling for an AI girlfriend? This is obviously when we're talking about AI.
Yes, I have. Great movie, and also very... very prescient. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. But I think that there were several films like this where there wasn't one with a robot. She wasn't an AI. She was an actual robot. And then there was one there was a German one similar that I heard about. It's been a thing. It's been a concern for the last 10 years or so.
Is great, because it's about a guy who falls in love with one of these, like, essentially Siri, an AI chatbot, and imagines what that would look like 20 years in the future. And of course, we're already 10 years out from that movie, or close to it. But the movie kind of culminates in the AI getting so smart that she loses interest in this guy.
Right. I see. Okay. Well, that's great. Thank you for appearing. This has been a different kind of stream. It's quite laid back, but I think it's been informative and we've talked about a lot of different things. So I would ask people to have a look at your Substack and your Twitter, but especially your Substack, because as we've outlined here, I think it's a really useful resource, not just for publicizing other people's work, but also for cataloging the life of the dissident right. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. I apologize again for the lateness, but this was a really fun conversation.
Oh, that's great. Don't worry about the lateness. We got through it, and we've had a good conversation, which is the whole point.
Have a Merry Christmas.
Okay, you too. I will be back very soon with Pox Populi, but in the meantime, New Right Post, Dudley, thanks for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye for now.
On this anniversary year, a true bounty can be found in the merchandise store. T-shirts, mugs, and an incredible range of posters. All exclusive products. Every one the perfect way to remember this unique time. At the end of the festival, a very special poster will be available. But no need to wait for that. See what you can pick up today.